Like this podcast? Please rate and review us. Don't want to miss an episode? Please subscribe.
And thanks for joining us today on Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. It's Tuesday, May 12th, and here are the storylines being discussed in the nation's capital. The House has introduced a new 1,800-page economic relief bill that could total $3 trillion. And it includes aid to state and local governments, which so far has been a non-starter in the Senate. The House is scheduled to vote on this legislation on Friday. Also today, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health testified that reopening schools in September is questionable, and the Supreme Court continues to hear cases via teleconference. So we'll start tonight with the Senate Health Committee, which heard testimony remotely from Anthony Fauci today. Most senators were also remote, and the Health Committee heard Dr. Fauci's views on whether states are reopening too quickly and whether or not it's time to restart the economy. Here's an exchange with the top Democrat on the committee, Senator Patty Murray of Washington State.
Dr. Fauci, you have warned of needless suffering and death if we push to reopen too soon, but the president has actually been sending the opposite message. I want to ask you today, what is the most important message you have for communities and states that are reopening, even as our public health experts make it clear it's too soon? Tell us what the consequences are.
Thank you very much for that question, Senator Murray. As I've said many times publicly, what we have worked out is a guideline framework of how to safely open America again. And there are several checkpoints in that, with a gateway first of showing, depending on the dynamics of an outbreak in a particular region, state, city, or area, that would really determine the speed and the pace with which one does re-enter or reopen. So my word has been, and I've been very consistent in this, that I get concerned if you have a situation where the dynamics of an outbreak in an area are such that you are not seeing that gradual over 14-day decrease that would allow you to go to phase one. And then if you pass the checkpoints of phase one, go to phase two and phase three. What I've expressed then and again is my concern that if some areas, cities, states, or what have you, jump over those various checkpoints and prematurely open up without having the capability of being able to respond effectively and efficiently, my concern is that we will start to see little spikes that might turn into outbreaks. So therefore, I have been being very clear in my message to try to the best extent possible to go by the guidelines, which have been very well thought out and very well delineated.
So if a community or a state or a region doesn't go by those guidelines and reopen, the consequences could be pretty dire, correct?
The consequences could be serious, particularly, and this is something that I think we also should pay attention to, that states, even if they're doing it at an appropriate pace, which many of them are and will, namely a pace that's commensurate with the dynamics of the outbreak, that they have in place already the capability that when there will be cases, there is no doubt, even under the best of circumstances, when you pull back on mitigation, you will see some cases appear. It's the ability and the capability of responding to those cases with good identification, isolation, and contact tracing will determine whether you can continue to go forward as you try to reopen America. So it's not only doing it at the appropriate time with the appropriate constraints, but having in place the capability of responding when the inevitable return of infections occur.
And that was Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, and Anthony Fauci of NIH. Dr. Fauci added that he is almost certain the death toll is higher than reported. Now, because of the virus's spread within the White House, Dr. Fauci and three other witnesses, CDC Director Robert Redfield, FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn, and HHS's Dr. Garrar were in quarantine and delivered their testimony remotely. Committee Chair Lamar Alexander was also remote after one of his staffers tested positive for coronavirus over the weekend. In his remarks, the Tennessee Republican emphasized the need to begin a return to normalcy and called for ramping up of the nation's testing and tracing capabilities. Senator Alexander's views echoed the sentiments many Republicans have expressed in recent weeks, warning about long-term damage lockdowns and other restrictions and the effect that they have had on the economy. Now back to Dr. Fauci's testimony. Here he is with Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky.
We're opening up a lot of economies around the U.S., and I hope that people who are predicting doom and gloom and saying, oh, we can't do this, there's going to be a surge, will admit that they were wrong if there isn't a surge, because I think that's what's going to happen. In rural states, we never really reached any sort of pandemic levels in Kentucky and other states. We have less deaths in Kentucky than we have in an average flu season. It's not to say this isn't deadly, but really, outside of New England, we've had a relatively benign course for this virus nationwide. And I think the one-size-fits-all that we're going to have a national strategy and nobody's going to go to school is kind of ridiculous. We really ought to be doing it school district by school district. And the power needs to be dispersed because people make wrong predictions. And really, the history of this, when we look back, will be of wrong prediction after wrong prediction after wrong prediction, starting with Ferguson in England. So I think we ought to have a little bit of humility in our belief that we know what's best for the economy. And as much as I respect you, Dr. Fauci, I don't think you're the end all. I don't think you're the one person that gets to make a decision. We can listen to your advice, but there are people on the other side saying there's not going to be a surge and that we can safely open the economy. And the facts will bear this out. But if we keep kids out of school for another year, what's going to happen is the poor and underprivileged kids who don't have a parent that's able to teach them at home are not going to learn for a full year. And I think we ought to look at the Swedish model, and we ought to look at letting our kids get back to school. I think it's a huge mistake if we don't open the schools in the fall. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that even though there are only 32 seconds left?
Yes, and you might make it clear whether or not you suggested that we shouldn't go back to school in the fall.
Well, first of all, Senator Paul, thank you for your comments. I have never made myself out to be the end-all and only voice in this. I'm a scientist, a physician, and a public health official. I give advice according to the best scientific evidence. There are a number of other people who come into that and give advice that are more related to the things that you spoke about the need to get the country back open again and economically. I don't give advice about economic things. I don't give advice about anything other than public health. So I wanted to respond to that. The second thing is that you use the word we should be humble about what we don't know. And I think that falls under the fact that we don't know everything about this virus. And we really better be very careful, particularly when it comes to children. Because the more and more we learn, we're seeing things about what this virus can do that we didn't see from the studies in China or in Europe. For example, right now, children presenting with COVID-19, who actually have a very strange inflammatory syndrome, very similar to Kawasaki's syndrome. I think we better be careful if we are not cavalier in thinking that children are completely immune to the deleterious effects. So again, you're right in the numbers that children in general do much, much better than adults and the elderly, and particularly those with underlying conditions. But I am very careful and hopefully humble in knowing that I don't know everything about this disease, and that's why I'm very reserved in making broad predictions.
And David Lim covers health for Politico. Mr. Lim, what was the tenor of today's hearing?
The tenor of today's hearing was really focused primarily on how the United States will be able to test adequately for the coronavirus to be able to contain it as we move forward into the fall months when some health experts are concerned that we might see a second wave of infections related to the coronavirus. So a lot of the senators were very focused on questioning administration officials on that topic.
What was the reaction to Dr. Fauci's questioning whether schools will reopen in September?
So Anthony Fauci today was testifying that the U.S. could face serious consequences if states don't have the capacity to respond to COVID outbreaks as they might spike up in the fall. Especially if states push forward with reopening too rapidly. On schools, specifically HHS, they're calling him the testing czar, Brett Jawa. was questioned about this by Senator Lamar Alexander, and he really was focusing on point-of-care tests that might be able to be used in university or other school settings to routinely screen students for coronavirus before outbreaks spread too rapidly.
Did you get the sense from Chair Alexander that he is looking to see the economy reopen this summer?
I think all senators and the American public are eager to return to some semblance of normal. But I think what health experts, including Fauci, were speaking about at the hearing today is that there are strong measures and considerations that we need to take into account before moving too rapidly in case we see a rebound in the coronavirus in the United States.
Now, Senator Rand Paul, who has had the coronavirus, gave quite a lot of pushback today, didn't he?
Anthony Fauci definitely responded pretty poignantly to Senator Paul's questioning on children. I know that Senator Paul has been pushing pretty heavily to return students to school, but Fauci was really talking about not wanting to rush that decision without a greater understanding of how the virus impacts children. That's still an area that scientists are really getting a grasp on, and we're seeing some evidence that the virus, while it doesn't impact them to the degree that it does, the immunocompromised, the elderly, et cetera, still can have an impact, a severe impact on children.
So, David Lim, in today's hearing, was there a discussion on federalizing the reopening of the economy, or will it be a state-by-state effort?
I think this is one area where we're seeing a bit of a split between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. By and large, Democrats were pressing for a national response to the coronavirus to be organized. I think we're seeing evidence of this in the bill that was introduced today on the House side by Speaker Nancy Pelosi. They, in that bill, set aside $75 billion to build out a national surveillance system to detect and contain the coronavirus. So that's encompassing of contact tracing, testing. A lot of that money is being set aside for grants to states and localities. Democrats are also pressing HHS to put forward specific goals, specific numbers on how many tests they want to be conducted. We did see Jawad today outline that he believes that we will have the ability, if needed, to test up to 50 million people per month by about September as we continue to expand testing using new types of tests, including antigen tests, which detect the protein of the virus, as opposed to nucleic acid testing for PCR tests, which is the majority of what we're using currently.
And David Lim covers health for Politico. Thank you for joining us on Washington Today.
Thanks so much for having me again.
And you're listening to C-SPAN's WCSP Radio. I'm Peter Slan. Now, also today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats introduced a new $3 trillion economic proposal to respond to the coronavirus. The speaker faced opposition from Republicans, who argued that the $2.4 trillion already appropriated in four previous relief measures needs to be assessed, and from progressive Democrats, who feel the bill doesn't go far enough. But Speaker Pelosi and top House Democrats will proceed despite political attacks from the left and right, arguing that the current 14.7% unemployment rate justifies the need for Congress to, quote, think big in its response to the pandemic. The vote on this proposal happens Friday morning in the House. Here is Speaker Pelosi from earlier this afternoon.
We must think big for the people now, because if we don't, it will cost more in lives and livelihood later. Not acting is the most expensive course. We are presenting a plan to do what is necessary to deal with the corona crisis and make sure we can get the country back to work and school safely. We have a goal. We have benchmarks. We have the science to succeed. In this critical moment for our country, we must demonstrate a clear strategy of testing, tracing, and treatment again. We must honor our heroes in the coronavirus crisis with support, not just words. We must address the pain of families who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own. I'm proud of the chairs of our committees of jurisdiction for the work on all five bills. We must all take an extra moment to understand the numbers we are seeing, which are the most overwhelming in our lifetimes. These numbers require action that we've never had to take before. There are those who said, let's just pause. But the families who are suffering know that hunger doesn't take a pause, the rent doesn't take a pause, the bills don't take a pause, the hardship of losing a job or tragically losing a loved one doesn't take a pause. This is an historic challenge and therefore a momentous opportunity for us to meet the needs of the American people to save their lives, their livelihoods, and our democracy. 400 years ago, the great poet John Donne wrote, no man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Each man's death diminishes me, for I'm involved in mankind. Therefore, send now to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. America's heart is full of love, and our tradition is one of optimism and hope. Let us pray for those who are affected. Let us pray for a cure and a vaccine. And let us pray to God to continue to bless America.
And that was Speaker Pelosi this afternoon on Capitol Hill. The roughly 1,800-page HEROES Act proposal includes $875 billion for state and local governments, $20 billion each for tribal nations and U.S. territories, $75 billion in mortgage relief, $100 billion in assistance for renters, $25 billion for the U.S. Postal Service, and $3.6 billion for election security. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's reaction to the House proposal.
Do you oppose some of the key provisions in this House bill, like direct payments for Americans, another round, or hazard pay for essential workers, or more money for food assistance for low-income Americans?
Well, what I've said is we're taking a look at what we've already done. We've added about $3 trillion to the national debt, and assessing the effectiveness of that before deciding to go forward. I'm in discussion, we all are, with the administration. If we reach a decision along with the administration to move to another phase, that'll be the time to interact with the Democrats. But what you've seen in the House, Nancy, is not something designed to deal with reality, but designed to deal with aspirations. This is not a time for aspirational legislation. This is a time for practical response to the coronavirus pandemic. And so we're going to insist on doing narrowly targeted legislation, if and when we do legislate again, and we may well, that addresses the problems, the needs, and not the aspirations of the Democratic majority in the House.
But you could be open to some of these provisions.
What we are going to do is exactly what I just said.
And that was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at about 1 p.m. this afternoon. It's unlikely that Congress will pass another relief package before June. Now, to recap, the House Democrats have proposed $3 trillion in additional coronavirus relief. $2.4 trillion has already been approved. To put that in perspective, the total federal budget is less than $5 trillion a year, which includes $1 trillion spent annually on Social Security. And now to politics. Speaking yesterday at a Trump online campaign event, the majority leader, while being questioned by President Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, answered the following.
Yeah, well, we know the Democrats always like more government and generally Republicans like less government. So I guess Leader McConnell, no surprise there. I want to touch on something that we kind of spoke about earlier. Former President Obama slammed President Trump's coronavirus response. And I think it was kind of unnecessary for the former president to criticize President Trump, especially given the Obama and Biden administration did not prepare our nation for a pandemic, as we just discussed. What is your response to that?
You know, generally, former presidents just don't do that. I remember President George W. Bush and his father. Went right through 8 years of Democratic administrations after they left office, and kept their mouths shut because they didn't feel it was appropriate for former presidents to be in, to critique even a president of another party. So I think President Obama should have kept his mouth shut. You know, we know he doesn't like much this administration is doing. That's understandable. But I think it's a little bit classless, frankly, to critique an administration that comes after you. You had your shot. You were there for 8 years. I think the tradition that the Bushes set up of not critiquing the president who comes after you is a good tradition.
And that was yesterday during a Trump online campaign event. Now, back on Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke about the continued challenges posed by COVID-19. Discussing yesterday's Rose Garden news conference, he demanded to know, quote, what planet President Trump is living on, after he said that the U.S. had met the moment and prevailed with regard to coronavirus testing. Here's the Senate Minority Leader.
The lack of urgency in the Republican Party extends down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Oval Office. From almost the very beginning of this crisis, President Trump has downplayed its severity and tried to wish it out of existence. The president said coronavirus might disappear miraculously, his word. He said it was a hoax. He said the warm weather might take care of it. He pitched quack medicines and speculated that a vaccine could be ready in 2 months. 2 months ago, the president said that anybody who wants a test can get a test, which is not even close to being true. The president's words are reckless. Constant belittling of the crisis, ignoring the crisis, burying the truth, and burying his head in the sand. And it has prolonged and made the crisis worse, and the American people know it. That's why he lashes out, the president does, at reporters who ask him fair questions. That's why he knows he's to blame for a good part of the depth and prolongation of this crisis. He knows that. And yet he can't bring himself to face the truth. He can't bring himself to tell the American people the truth. Pitching quack medicines, telling people it's going to go away, saying yesterday that we have met the moment and we have prevailed, what planet is he on? More than 30 million unemployed and we have prevailed? 1.3 million infected, 80,000 American fatalities? Those numbers still growing and we have prevailed? The president's comments show a stunning disregard for the truth. And it hurts every American. I don't care what your politics is. No one should tolerate a president who ignores the truth, says whatever pops into his head, whether it's true or false or dangerous, and then moves on his merry way to do the next, speak the next untruth, talk about the next quack cure. The president's comments show a stunning disregard for the truth. It may have been in the Rose Garden and not on the deck of a battleship, but President Trump saying we have prevailed is akin to declaring mission accomplished long before the battles are over and the war is won. Now, later on, the president, as usual, tries to correct what he said, or his advisors do. He said he only meant testing. We had prevailed on testing. But that's false, too. Even the corrections are false. The United States is testing about 300,000 people a day. Most experts believe the number is inadequate to stop this outbreak and ensure that when we reopen, we do so safely. We have prevailed on testing, not remotely.
And this is Washington Today on WCSP-FM Radio. I'm Peter Slen. Now, the Supreme Court heard three more cases today via teleconference. All were live on C-SPAN. The court heard two oral arguments, both dealing with subpoenas for President Trump's financial records. The first oral argument focused on the congressional subpoenas to financial institutions for some of President Trump's records. The court will consider whether the U.S. House has authority to issue subpoenas to these third-party entities. Following these, in the third case, the justices heard about the investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office into alleged misconduct by the Trump Organization. In this case, the court will consider whether the president has immunity from the subpoena for information that is unrelated to his duties as president of the United States. Now, here's a back and forth between Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Patrick Strawbridge, attorney for President Trump during the first case.
Counsel, in so many of these prior cases, there was a cooperation. For example, tax returns. Every president voluntarily turned over his tax returns. So it gets to be a pitched battle here because President Trump is the first one to refuse to do that. And initially he said because of an audit was ongoing. Now it seems to be broader than that. But the aura of this case is really sauce for the goose that served the gander as well. So how do you distinguish, say, Whitewater, when President Clinton's personal records were subpoenaed from his accountant, or even Hillary Clinton's law firm billing records were subpoenaed? It seems that in prior cases, you say this one is one of a kind, but it seems in prior cases there was a much greater collision of interests. Take the Nixon tapes. How do you distinguish all of those cases, Watergate, Whitewater, the Nixon tapes case, the Paula Jones case?
Well, Your Honor, we distinguish them in a number of ways. With respect to Watergate and Whitewater, obviously those are cases of relatively recent vintage, and in separation of powers disputes, this court has generally, such as in Noel Canning, looked back for a much longer precedent for the type of issue that needs to be decided, examples of the encroachment upon the separation of powers. And the recent examples, and there are just a handful of them that the House identifies, are too recent, you know, under that stricture, as the court recognized in Southwest General. Now, it's also important to note that almost all of those cases, I think all of those cases, actually involve cooperative efforts. And as the court recognized below, consent is not the measure of constitutionality. In none of those cases was there a challenge to the scope or to the power of the legislative committee in that case to request those documents. And I think Whitewater.
Thank you, counsel.
And that was Attorney for President Trump Patrick Strawbridge being questioned by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, from the Supreme Court's oral hearings today, we have Justice Brett Kavanaugh questioning Douglas Letter, who's the attorney for the House of Representatives. This is in regard to the power of the legislative branch.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and good morning, Mr. Letter. I want to follow up on the line of questioning that several of my colleagues have pursued, the Chief Justice, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Alito, Justice Kagan, and others, which I think come down to the idea of limitless authority and how to deal with that. The other side says that allowing these subpoenas and subpoenas like these, say for medical records, would be a grave threat to future presidencies. It would be open season, they say, on private records of anyone who is president and maybe other government officials too. And they worry about the harassing nature of subpoenas like that. You say, and Justice Gorsuch was just exploring this, it's okay so long as it's pertinent to a legislative purpose. But I think everyone has explored with you that just about everything can be characterized in terms of a subpoena as pertinent to a legislative purpose. I don't think you could answer the Chief Justice's question about something that wasn't. And the question then boils down to how can we both protect the House's interests in obtaining information it needs to legislate, but also protect the presidency? How can the court balance those interests? I guess the thing I would say is why not employ the demonstrably critical standard or something like that? This is what the other side would say. as something that's borrowed from a different context, but that might serve to balance the strong competing concerns here?
Your Honor, that's a very good question. I have several responses. The first one goes to the last thing you said about why not employ a demonstrably critical test. I don't know how the courts would do that without violating the separation of powers. I was reminded recently by the congressional leaders that often they're doing investigations. They don't know where the legislation might go at that point. So I don't know how you would force Congress to do to show some sort of demonstrably critical reason.
Well, wouldn't it be the same way that it's shown in an investigation where executive privilege is asserted, and the demonstrably critical standard in that context has been the tried and true method for about 50 years?
Because then, Your Honor, you could demand that the executive branch show that its reason for seeking something outweighs the executive privilege claim. But here, and remember, we're not dealing with executive privilege at all. These are financial business records. It's difficult to see how these could ever come within that kind of balance that would override Congress's authority to do investigation. The one other thing I can suggest, obviously, is this court has suggested, I believe, is the voters. But also Nixon versus Fitzgerald, where this court said that the president has absolute immunity from certain kinds of claims. The court said specifically that one of the reasons that's okay is because we have congressional oversight of the president. This court specifically used that to justify absolute immunity for the president in other areas.
And now joining us on Washington Today is the Washington Post, David Farenthold. Mr. Farenthold, why were there three cases today that the Supreme Court heard?
Well, there's three different groups of people who are trying to get Trump's financial records, President Trump's financial records, from sort of different legal standpoints and different goals. The most important ones are members of Congress, different committees in Congress who have asked for some of the president's financial records, and also the Manhattan District Attorney, who has asked for some Trump Organization financial records as part of an investigation into hush money payments in 2016.
So does this go into the emoluments as well?
It does not really. We've heard so much about emoluments, but the emoluments cases have been tripped up on the question of who even has the right to start an emoluments case, to file an emoluments case. In these cases, the question of standing was not so much an issue, but rather the question for today was, what can you get from a president? You know, these folks, Congress and the Manhattan DA, they conceded that these are people who have the right to investigate other people, but how much does a president have to give them?
And so we're looking at executive power versus legislative power.
And versus law enforcement power. It's sort of, there was two distinct cases, and I think one of them went well for Trump and one of them went poorly for Trump. The congressional one, I thought, went pretty well for him, surprisingly well for him. But then the case involving the Manhattan DA, I thought, went poorly for Trump. It seemed like he was likely to lose there.
Why do you say that?
Well, the House had a not very good lawyer. The House's lawyer, when they were asking for their, you know, making the case that they should be allowed to have access to Trump's financial records, the court kept asking them for a limit on that power. Okay, if you say Congress has the power to seek the president's financial records, you know, how far does that go? Are there cases where the Congress couldn't get the president's records? Could they not take a sample of his blood? Could they, you know, are all the, there were, you know, where's the limit? And the House's lawyer basically said, well, the only limit is we can ask for records on anything that legislation maybe had upon, basically any subject for possible legislation. So the justices kept saying, well, you know, is there any limit to that? I mean, can't you just list legislation on anything? And the House's lawyer couldn't really come up with a good answer to that. On the other hand, the Manhattan District Attorney seemed to be saying, look, you know, we have a legitimate law enforcement power here, and if you don't let us get these records from the president, you're basically giving him and everybody connected to him immunity from prosecution for the whole length of his term.
So, David Farenthold, is there any precedent for a president, A, not giving financial records, and B, should he or she be compelled to?
Well, the two the classic cases that are sort of seen as the precedent here are one from Watergate and one from Whitewater, where President Clinton was sort of trying to avoid being deposed. And the president's lost both those cases in these sort of famous landmark unanimous rulings where even justices that the president had appointed came in and said, look, no, you're not above the law. No president is a king. And so that's the backdrop to this. The Supreme Court has spoken with one voice in these two recent cases and said, you know, the president is not above the law. I don't think that both of these cases are likely to be unanimous, especially the one involving Congress sounded like it was going to be a split decision. But that's the backdrop here. Congress doesn't want to be seen. The Supreme Court doesn't want to be seen as, you know, telling Trump that he's free to ignore rules, that, you know, the president is different than any other man. But they may do that in this case, or at least qualify it.
And now, of course, C-SPAN carried these teleconference cases live today. And when you were listening, did you hear any justices that stood out to you?
I thought John Roberts and Neil Gorsuch, particularly, both Republican appointed judges, asked really interesting questions. Roberts, particularly, was very hard on the House's lawyer. You know, he saying a couple of different times, you know, this test you've put out is not really a test, it's a limitless power. And then the next hour, really going hard after President Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, who had basically said that the president has a limitless power. The president has temporary immunity from all prosecution while he's president. You know, I think Roberts asked really good questions. You know, I'm not a Supreme Court veteran. I only cover the Trump Organization cases. But the reading I've seen taken away by Supreme Court veterans was that Roberts sort of sent mixed signals. And if you had to guess at the outcome, you might think he would be for Trump on the House case and against Trump on the Manhattan DA case.
And you mentioned that you do cover the Trump Organization. You've written a book about it, in fact.
Yes. I've covered President Trump's charitable giving or promises about charitable giving and his business basically since the beginning of 2016.
Do we know anything about the Trump Organization? Its financials?
We do. We don't know as much about it as we do about other companies. It's a private company that doesn't say very much about itself. But we've now learned a bit about it. From public records, times when it sort of has to tell a little bit of itself to the public. We know it's not doing that well now, especially because it's had to close so many of its properties. It wasn't doing that well before because President Trump had driven so much of its old customers away. And we know it relies a lot on Trump's allies and on the government itself to sort of put money into its properties.
So when do we expect a decision on these three cases?
The summer is what I'm told now. The Supreme Court does not work fast, but in this case, I think we'll see it before the heat of the fall election season.
Is there any chance it could be delayed until after the election?
I mean, you never say never, especially with the pandemic going on, but that's the reasoning I've been hearing is it's going to happen at the end of this term in the summer.
And you can read in the Washington Post David Farenthold and his colleagues' full report on today's Supreme Court cases. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today.
Thank you.
And finally, we check in on campaign 2020. Former Vice President Joe Biden spoke with Good Morning America's George Stephanopoulos about when he'll get out on the campaign trail.
When do you expect to get out on the campaign trail?
Well, we're on the campaign trail now. You know, everybody says, you know, Biden's hiding. Well, let me tell you something. We're doing very well. We're following the guidelines of the medical profession. We're following the guidelines of the experts, the Dr. Fauci's of the world. We're doing very well. And matter of fact, we're winning if you look at all the polling data. I'm not saying that's going to last till November. I don't know enough to know that. But right now, the idea that somehow we are being hurt by my keeping to the rules and following the instructions that have been put forward by the docs is absolutely bizarre. I reject the premise that somehow this is hurting us. There's no evidence of that. I'm following the rules. Following the rules. The president should follow the rules instead of showing up at places without masks and the whole thing. Look, this is, I'm getting really frustrated with not you, with this, the whole notion that somehow there is, we can just open, we can move. I mean, I'm anxious to go out and campaign, George. You know, when I campaign, I'm usually the first one there and the last one to leave. I enjoy interfacing with people. I'm not trying to avoid it, but I'm trying to set an example as to how we should proceed in terms of dealing with this health and economic crisis.
Finally, Mr. Vice President.
Damage so far that I can see.
And that was a little bit from Good Morning America's interview with Joe Biden. Now, remember, if you missed any of today's program or want to hear it again, listen to the podcast. You can find it by searching Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can find it on our website, cspan.org/podcasts.